From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, devastation revealed from the Russian occupation in Ukraine. And the question, does what is happening constitute a war crime?
And some of those essential rules include that military objectives will be targeted, not civilians. Certain weapons will not be used, and that weapons will be used in a non-indiscriminate fashion.
A shakeup in the social media world. Elon Musk joins the board of Twitter. What it could mean for free speech on the platform.
So he may be trying in his ownership stake not only to control the message, but to change strategy within the company so that it's a stickier platform that is able to monetize its users better.
And baseball is finally back. But will fans be there?
Just talking to my brother-in-law, who had big Mariners tickets for next week, was bringing his son. And I mean, none of those games got canceled. They're still happening. I mean, if anything, I think there was that scare of like, oh, shoot, like, am I not going to be able to go watch my team this summer?
All ahead on Perspective. The atrocities of war have started to be revealed in the areas around Kyiv as Russian troops move out for what they say is a concentration of operations in eastern Ukraine. What we've seen and found is heartbreaking. We'll have a report from the ground from one of those towns in a moment. But first, we'll talk about the Ukrainian refugee crisis that's growing not only in Europe, but along the U.S. border with Mexico in Tijuana. The number of Ukrainians arriving at the border is growing by the day. They're hoping to be granted entrance into the U.S. under refugee laws. The Biden administration has said it will accept up to 100,000 Ukrainians and that officers at the border can accept them on a case-by-case basis, despite the COVID-era Title 42 rule, which has limited refugee claims during the pandemic. Title 42 will end next month. We're going to have more on that later in the show. For now, we can tell you that Ukrainians are traveling to Mexico because they don't need a visa to enter that country as they do to enter the U.S. Many are young families who are hoping to start a new life in the U.S. Special lines are being set up at the border for Ukrainians. They are able to cross while other refugees are not, some say. ABC's Alex Stone traveled to Tijuana this week and reports on what he saw.
It's the sound of lives in limbo, Sherry. Crying babies and their parents are frustrated. They're exhausted, waiting for the chance to enter the U.S. Customs and Border Protection building here to claim asylum. But until they get that chance, they wait. They're out in the mist and the blaring sun, depending on the day, camped out in what was a bus stop, but is now a shelter for so many Ukrainian citizens waiting to enter the U.S. On bullhorns, names are called out one by one. They're told to come to the front, that soon it will be their time to go inside and make their case for asylum. Volunteers who have come from the U.S. and Mexico have a handwritten list on a yellow pad of paper. Every family arriving is put on that list to avoid chaos, and then their name is called when they can go inside. Victoria has been here for days and lost track of time.
It's like a second or third day, I don't remember actually. Yeah.
What was an adrenaline-filled journey to get here has now worn into exhaustion and emotion. She tears up, telling me,
it's like really, you know, first day it was like normal. You're excited about all the help we receive here, because when I came here, I really didn't know about all the volunteer stuff, and it was like actually wow. And like on a third day, it's really hard.
These are mostly young families, parents who had jobs and lives in Ukraine but left when the bombs started falling. They came here to Mexico because it doesn't require them to have a visa to enter. They flew to get to the front door of the U.S. to ask for help, asylum. Andre lives in eastern Ukraine and fled through Russia undercover to get out.
I was lucky to have good people in Donetsk, and so I had to give a bribe. Sorry for that. I had to give a bribe, and to some of my friends, they like guys from the government of Donetsk public republic, and so they helped me to they got me to the border. So I haven't had any problems during the trip in Donetsk. But I had some problems when I got to Russia.
He says he was interrogated and stripped. They looked for any Nazi tattoos on his body, but he made his way out. And now he's here waiting to ask for asylum when his turn comes up.
Now we have to come to Mexico, and we're like nervous because we don't know. Maybe in Mexico they will depart us back to the country where we came from. So it's not easy. It's like a risk. I'm a risky guy, and other also, but we have people who want, who has relatives, who has family in United States, and they want to come, but they can't.
Children here play with donated toys. Food has been brought in by volunteers. Today's lunch, donated Costco pizza. Large rats run around. Those who are lucky enough to be admitted into the U.S. come out on the other side, in San Diego, where Ukrainian Americans are waiting to help them, like Mariana, who has lived in the U.S. for 22 years.
We are providing transportation. We're taking them. Most of them have their family here, and they're going somewhere. Some of them go to different states, and they need one day or two to stay here until they buy a ticket, and then until they move on to whatever their final destination.
Many arriving have the means to buy airline tickets once on the U.S. side to go where they want to be with family or friends, but they are pleading with the U.S. government to bring in more help here to process the asylum claims. It is a long wait for so many families. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News, in Tijuana, Mexico.
In Ukraine, in towns like Chernihiv and Bucha, the devastation that Russia has leveled against the Ukrainian people has been shocking. Videos show the bodies of people killed with their hands tied behind their backs, left lying in the street, mass grave next to a church, a mayor and her family left in a shallow grave. That's just some of what's been discovered. President Biden denounced Russia and President Vladimir Putin for carrying out war crimes.
Responsible nations have to come together to hold these perpetrators accountable. And together with our allies and our partners, we're going to keep raising the economic cost and ratchet up the pain for Putin and further increase Russia's economic isolation.
The worry now is that authorities move into towns that Russia occupied for longer periods of time, the atrocities will get worse. ABC's James Longman traveled to Bucha, a northern suburb of Kyiv, this week.
With the utter devastation in Ukraine getting clearer by the day, new disturbing images emerge from the destruction left behind. This week, we met Mikola, who told us about the three friends he watched die and had to bury in his own backyard.
At least one of them was shot in front of him.
We took a Human Rights Watch researcher to the crime scene.
It's almost impossible to walk around the streets of Bucha and not see evidence of violence, and in some cases, what appear to be war crimes.
We traveled to Borodyanka, which was under Russian occupation for weeks. 13,000 people once lived here, now reduced to rubble.
The other thing about this town is that all you really hear is the sound of crows. There are very few people, because there's nothing for them to come back to.
This man's home, one of the many destroyed in the attacks. He tells us when the Russians invaded, he could hear the planes overhead dropping bombs and helicopters flying just above the houses.
Throughout the week, the terms war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, crimes of aggression have been used to describe what's been happening in Ukraine. But what do those actually mean? We asked Kate McIntosh, the executive director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law, an expert on international war crimes.
When we're talking about atrocities that are committed, like we've seen what's going on in Bucha.
Bodies left in streets as Russian troops withdrew. Some shot in the back of the head with their hands tied behind their backs. Civilians executed in cold blood. Bodies dumped into mass graves.
Is an atrocity that's committed during war, is that a legal term?
That is not a legal term, no. The international crimes that exist, that are prosecuted at the International Criminal Court, are war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, which can also be carried out in times of peace, as can genocide, and the crime of aggression. And those are the technical terms.
Explain to me the difference between each of those, if you could.
Absolutely. So a war crime is a violation of the rules of war. So that is, a war crime can only be committed during armed conflict, and it's about the war and the way the war is being fought.
In Bucha, images that will define this war. Residents say Russian forces shot civilians on the spot. This woman says she was walking when a Russian soldier fired at her with a machine gun. She made it home, saying she was beside herself.
Genocide protects human groups from destruction. So to commit a genocide, somebody has to have the intent to destroy a human group in whole or in part.
President Volodymyr Zelensky is now accusing the Russians of genocide, saying Ukrainians are being destroyed and exterminated.
Because we saw that in Rwanda. Of course, we saw that in the Holocaust and so on. So when a particular group is targeted for destruction, crimes against humanity can be carried out in times of war or peace. And a crime against humanity is a widespread or systematic attack on a civilian population.
Authorities here telling us more than 400 people were killed. Streets littered with bodies, a small bag of groceries beside another victim.
It's about a widespread attack on a civilian population. And finally, the crime of aggression, which is very relevant here, is exactly what was committed, and I think we can say that without any evidentiary problem, by Russia invading Ukraine.
Bucha is one town. Russians occupied huge swathes of this country. They sat on towns like Bucha for weeks, and there is every chance that they did the same everywhere they stayed.
It seems to me, even before we saw what we have seen coming out of the Kyiv suburb of Bucha, we had already seen evidence. You know, how hard is it to prove what's been going on in places like Mariupol and other parts of Ukraine that we have seen civilians being targeted?
Well, the fact that civilians have been caught up in the fighting does not necessarily prove that they've been targeted, right? So it is possible to imagine that the Russian forces targeted a legitimate military objective, Ukrainian military post, for example, and that in that fighting, they also managed to hit civilians. And some amount of collateral damage is permitted and does not amount to a war crime. So that's why people have been somewhat hesitant to state that war crimes have definitely been committed, because without really speaking to the survivors and understanding what had happened on the ground, you can't make a definitive conclusion, and that would need, you know, a judicial investigation. The difference that the photos and the media coverage coming out of Bucha has made is this issue of civilian bodies or bodies dressed in civilian clothing being found with hands tied, for example, and signs of torture on the body, which obviously looks as though these were not people who were caught up in the fighting. That looks very strongly like prima facie evidence of war crimes.
That was Kate McIntosh, the executive director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the UCLA School of Law. Former U.S. Marine Trevor Reed was arrested in Moscow in 2019 while visiting his girlfriend, who is Russian. The 30-year-old was arrested after Russian authorities said he allegedly assaulted a police officer while drunk. It's a charge the family denies. His parents, Joey and Paula, have not seen their son in almost 3 years, and they're now afraid the ongoing conflict in Ukraine means their chances for his return are dwindling, especially with the news this week that Trevor was sent to a prison hospital. ABC's Brad Milkey spoke to Trevor Reed's parents on the ABC News Daily podcast Start Here. They talked about the latest developments in their fight to bring their son home.
Your son has very articulately defended himself in Russian courts. Like, we've seen the notes from his statements. He's talked about how, you know, there is video evidence demonstrating police officers were not being truthful about the events that night. He's outlined the conditions of where he's being held. Mm-hmm. You've said that we know that this is the longest sentence ever given to somebody for this charge. So I can't imagine what the last 3 years have been like for you. And then Russia goes to war with Ukraine. So talking about news events that seem to overshadow everything, what were your thoughts over the last couple months as Russia went to war with Ukraine? Because I imagine it all goes back to you and your son.
Well, prior to that, we were worried about it before the actual invasion.
Yeah, we've been telling government officials, you know, in the White House and elected officials that you need to get Paul Whelan and our son out of there before a war breaks out, because we may never see them again. They may place additional charges on them. They may start treating them even worse than they already are. I mean, the list goes on and on if a Ukraine war occurs, and yet they didn't. So here they are. Communications are diminished. We can't get mail to them any longer. We can't get money to them for basic things like toothpaste. So it's just going downhill fast.
And so that takes us to, you went to Washington. You did this very public protest right out in front of the White House. Were you expecting you get a meeting with President Biden last week?
Well, actually, before that, we had been asking for months to have a presidential meeting, and we've been just getting pushed off to the side. So on March 8th, we went to Fort Worth, VA, where the president was going to be. And he saw us and he called us and said that he would immediately have someone schedule a meeting. But immediately to him and immediately to us was different. So after it had been about 3 weeks, we decided to go to Washington. And we weren't expecting to get a meeting then. We just thought that they would see us and it would remind someone, oh, hey, that they need to be scheduled for a meeting. But we just, the timing worked out in our favor and we got lucky. So obviously we're not going to turn a meeting down, you know.
No, yeah, we were excited, you know, that he decided to go ahead and meet us while we were there. And we're very appreciative of that.
Yes.
Yeah, what can you tell me what was said in that conversation or what that conversation was like?
Well, first of all, he kind of gave us a little summary of you know where they're at on the situation, which we can't discuss that.
Okay.
And but you know that they continue you know to work to release him and or get him released. And so then he allowed us to talk uninterrupted for a long time. I mean, it had to have been over 30 minutes where we discussed you know him and his service in the Marine Corps, you know, protecting President Obama and him when he was vice president. And then what he's gone through in Russia and how he has basically acted as if he was a prisoner of war in World War II. He's refused to tell them anything. He's refused to work in the labor camp. He said, I'm not going to work for my hostage takers and make products for them to sell. And I think the president was, you know, pretty impressed by, you know, what we told him about our son. And we also advocated for Paul Whelan and for all of the other Americans that are held wrongfully or held hostage around the world right now, and that our government needs to start doing more to get them back faster. And if we can't force someone to do it, like Russia or China, then we need to deal with them like we deal with them on many other issues.
What was it like to leave that meeting then? How were you feeling?
We felt a little bit, a little pressure off of us, but, you know, at least we felt heard. And, you know, we felt like everything that we thought we would find about the president was true. Mm-hmm. And we feel better having just gone there and said our piece, you know, to him. And we feel that, he's a kind person. And we think that something will get moving faster now.
He's a good man. He had a son in the military. He's lost children. And, you know, and he's compassionate. And we believe that after hearing us out, that I can't imagine that he's not doing something to speed up the process for bringing our son home.
Joey and Paula Reed, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can listen to that full interview on the episode Trevor Reed's Parents to Biden, Get Him Out of There Alive, wherever you get your podcasts. History made this week in the U.S. Senate as Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was confirmed as the nation's next Supreme Court justice, the first black woman to ever serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. ABC congressional correspondent Rachel Scott has the story.
A moment 233 years in the making.
On this vote, the yeas are 53, the nays are 47, and this nomination is confirmed.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson cementing her place in history. Cheers ringing out in the chamber, senators wiping away tears, members of the Congressional Black Caucus crowding in the back. Republicans quickly filed out, walking past Mitt Romney of Utah as he stood applauding. Romney, along with Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the only Republican senators to vote yes. At the White House, President Biden and Judge Jackson watched together, hand in hand.
All right.
When the 51-year-old Jackson joins the court, for the first time in history, four of the nine justices will be women, and white men will be in the minority. Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia speaking to the meaning of the moment.
I'm the father of a young black girl. I know how much it means for Judge Jackson to have navigated the double jeopardy of racism and sexism to now stand in the glory of this moment in all of her excellence.
Former First Lady Michelle Obama tweeting, I can't help but feel a sense of pride, a sense of joy to know that this deserving, accomplished black woman will be part of the highest court in the land.
ABC's Rachel Scott. Coming up, we've told you about Title 42 ending at the U.S.-Mexico border. We're going to tell you more about what it is and the history behind it on Perspective after this.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Samsung. With Galaxy Watch 5 and Watch 5 Pro, Samsung's here to help you hit your wellness goals. Watch 5 features advanced health monitoring and a powerful battery, while Watch 5 Pro goes next level with new GPS features and up to 80 hours of usage. Your goals? Your choice. Visit Samsung.com to learn more about Galaxy Watch 5 and Watch 5 Pro. Features compatible with a smartphone with an Android 8.0 or later and RAM 1.5 gigabytes or more. Requires Samsung Health App 6.22 or later.
Hey everyone, it's George. We've got big news from GMA.
It's Michael.
It's Robin. You can now listen to Good Morning America from the comfort of your home or car or while you walk the dog.
We go where you go.
Because GMA is now available as a podcast.
Get the day's news, our exclusive interviews, and the latest business and health headlines.
GMA, the podcast.
Available for free wherever you listen.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, tough talk from the Federal Reserve is spooking some investors. Should you be worried? We'll ask an expert. But first, the focus of American politics and policy is back along the U.S.-Mexico border as new groups of asylum seekers, some from Ukraine and Russia, show up at the nation's doorstep. This comes even as President Biden prepares to ease immigration health restrictions known as Title 42, put into place by his predecessor, former President Trump. ABC's Jim Ryan has some background from Texas, a state that shares a 1,200-mile border with Mexico.
It's a term that gets tossed around a lot these days.
And because of Title 42, the city...
Title 42 is scheduled to expire. Unless...
On Title 42, a Trump-era...
You're amenable to Title 42. You're amenable to...
But what exactly is Title 42? Its roots stretch back three-quarters of a century. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen returning home from World War II ran the risk of bringing serious illness into the country.
This story is dedicated to them in the hope that it will speed the day when our whole nation shall be freed of man's ancient enemy, tuberculosis.
The Public Health Service Act of 1944 gave the government quarantine authority to keep out tuberculosis and malaria. Fast forward 76 years, and the United States faced a new health crisis, COVID. And President Trump resurrected Title 42 as a way to prevent its spread.
We will significantly impede the transmission of the virus. The virus will not have a chance against us. No nation is more prepared or more resilient than the United States.
Between October of 2020 and August of the following year, about 1 million immigrants were prohibited from entering the country under Title 42. Under pressure from congressional Democrats and based on recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, President Biden has promised to rescind the Title 42 restrictions, but with a 7-week waiting period in place.
It was always going to be important to have an implementation period, and the timeline reflects that.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Implementation of their decision requires an interagency process, specifically leadership of the Department of Homeland Security. I would note the statement that was put out by Secretary Mayorkas, and it requires the implementation of appropriate COVID-19 mitigation protocols.
But if pressure from his fellow Democrats is prompting President Biden's decision to scrap Title 42, it's pressure from Republicans, including some former Trump staffers, that has Texas Governor Greg Abbott pushing back.
Effective immediately, the Texas Department of Public Safety will conduct enhanced safety inspections of vehicles as they cross the international points of entry into Texas.
Mark Jones is a political science professor at Rice University in Houston. He says Governor Abbott, who faces a challenge in November from Democrat Beto O'Rourke, has seized on a political opportunity developing along the Rio Grande.
Abbott knows that policy is unpopular with the majority of Texans, and therefore, to the extent to which he can tie Texas Democrats like Beto O'Rourke to Joe Biden's policies, it's likely to be beneficial for him in November.
Greg Abbott is running for a third term in the Texas governor's mansion, and he's made immigration and border issues a crown jewel of his campaign. With a new surge in asylum seekers intensifying daily, Abbott has promised to take the problem directly to the feet of the person he blames, President Biden.
Texas is providing charter buses to send these illegal immigrants who have been dropped off by the Biden administration to Washington, D.C.
But as Rice University's Mark Jones points out, the charter buses are largely symbolic.
You cannot make anyone take that bus ride.
Immigrants would have to be processed into the country and then voluntarily accept the ride to Washington. It all comes to a head on May 23rd when Title 42 is set to go away. Republican lawmakers are lining up and demanding that the restrictions stay in place. Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News, Dallas.
Tough talk from the Federal Reserve has been ratcheting up anxiety among investors, with stocks on Wall Street taking a big dip early in the week. What message is the U.S. Central Bank sending, and what could it mean for the stock market and the U.S. economy for the rest of the year, as well as your own portfolio? Let's bring in Caleb Silver, the editor-in-chief at Investopedia. What are we looking at as far as the future and stocks and investments in this country?
Great question. We're going into a very, very different time. It's a time of rising interest rates. It's a time of high inflation, and it's a time of a slowdown in economic growth. And we come off coming off of very strong growth and a very strong stock market in 2021 and most of 2020, believe it or not. In fact, the last 3 years have produced very solid gains for investors. So our 401ks are healthy. If you're looking at it week to week, you're not going to love what you see in 2022 because it's been rocky. We're only down about 6-7% from all-time highs in the S&P 500.
Okay, when you're looking ahead, and we're, let's say, a five-year picture, as far as people go, when they've looked at it month to month, day to day, they always say it's not a good thing to do. Let's look ahead the next 5 years. What do we think we might see as far as investment goes?
Yeah, I think the market has always averaged 8-10% a year to the upside for the past 60 or 70 years. I think we're going to be in for a little bit lower than that just because we don't have the winds of our at our back with really low interest rates. We know the Fed is raising rates. They just started last month. We heard yesterday when we read through the minutes of their last meeting, they want to be a little bit more aggressive with that. Why are they doing that? They want to do that to cool inflation. And the economy, except for inflation, is in pretty decent shape. The labor market is about 93% back to where it was. Growth has been good and corporate profits have been strong, but we're just not going to have the kind of growth we had in the last year coming out of the recovery. So returns for the stock market, especially for those big tech stocks, which have been so powerful and driven the market higher, are just going to be a little bit more muted as rates rise. You got to be ready for that. That doesn't mean you can't invest in other parts of the world or in other sectors. You're going to find returns, but you have to have a balanced, diversified portfolio. Just don't expect these toward 10, 20, 30% gains year in, year out.
What are some of those sectors that people might want to be looking at? If you know, maybe you mentioned tech stocks there. What are some other things people might want to keep an eye on?
Well, you want to keep an eye on what's happening with energy stocks. They had a terrible 2020, obviously, during the pandemic, but have roared back at the end of 2021 and have been the best performing sector in 2022. Some folks don't want to hold fossil fuel stocks in their portfolios for reasons. But if you want to look around, look at the consumer staples, the things that we have to buy as the economy slows. Those are the companies, the Dollar Generals, and I'm not giving picks, but just the type of stocks, this type of companies that we're going to spend money on no matter what. Groceries, right? The basics that we need. And then look at the housing market, which is still red hot, cooling a little bit as mortgage rates rise, but housing stocks are still pretty hot. And then if you want to look at tech, look at cybersecurity, because we're going to need a lot more of it as it gets more and more dicey out there in our digital world.
Caleb, let's take inflation out of the picture. The price of gas, the price of groceries, we've heard so much about how that's hurting the typical American. What besides that do you think is the biggest challenge facing not just investors, but Americans in general?
Yeah, well, geopolitical uncertainty is right up there at the top. It's one of our readers' most pressing concerns, given the situation in Ukraine right now, obviously. But then it's rising interest rates. And we've been in this environment really for the last 13 to 15 years coming out of the great financial crisis, where rates have been very low, never really gone above 3%. And remember, folks that were around in the 70s and 80s, they think 3%, 4%, 5% is nothing compared to the 8, 10%. But we are going to have rising rates. So probably going to hit 2.5% by the end of the year. That's where the Fed wants them. When you know that and rates are rising, it's going to cool parts of the economy. It's going to cool lending because credit card loans become more expensive. Car loans become more expensive. Mortgages become a little bit more expensive. So you'll see a cool down there and that'll bleed through the rest of the economy. But as long as consumers keep spending and businesses keep expanding, the economy should be in relatively good shape.
That's Caleb Silver, editor-in-chief at Investopedia, who also has some thoughts about a big shakeup in the social media world this week. In a surprise move, Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk revealed he had bought up 9% of Twitter stock, becoming the social media company's largest shareholder. He'll also be joining Twitter's board of directors. Bit of a change from the last few weeks when Musk tweeted that the company was against free speech and that perhaps a new platform was needed. What could it mean for the future of Twitter? ABC Tech producer Mike DeBusky has more.
He's the techno king of Tesla, the co-founder of SpaceX, Grimes' ex-boyfriend, the world's richest man, and this week Elon Musk added another title to his roster, Twitter board member. On Monday, filings revealed that he had bought just over 9% of the social network's shares. The next day, Twitter's CEO announced Musk was joining the company's board of directors.
Almost everything Elon Musk does is kind of a surprise, but this move is kind of a little bit more of a surprise than usual.
Investopedia's Caleb Silver says Musk isn't just an investor at Twitter. He's one of its most prolific tweeters.
Elon Musk has been a heavy user of Twitter for years. He's accumulated 80 million followers.
But all that doesn't mean he's not critical of the platform, too. Wedbush Securities tech analyst Dan Ives.
It's no secret that Musk is not happy with the current social media landscape, especially with Twitter.
Just last month, Musk accused Twitter of undermining democracy by, quote, failing to adhere to free speech principles.
He's voiced those concerns, talked about building a social media landscape or a platform himself.
But his frustrations with the platform haven't stopped him from using it. Musk has control over his message, and cozying up to Twitter gives him a little more influence over the medium. Here's Caleb Silver again.
So he may be trying in his ownership stake not only to control the message, but to change strategy within the company so that it's a stickier platform that is able to monetize its users better.
But at the same time, Twitter needs Elon Musk, or at least someone like him.
Folks have been saying for years that Twitter has not effectively used its platform to monetize correctly.
It may feel like we hear about Twitter all the time, but it's actually a comparatively small player in the social media space. A 2019 study from the Pew Research Center found that 80% of the posts on the platform come from just 10% of the users. The rest of those accounts are more likely to tweet just once or twice a month, if at all. And fewer people looking at tweets means fewer people looking at advertisements.
Because it hasn't been as engaging or as monetizable as some of its competitors.
Twitter lost money last quarter and only managed to add about 6 million users. But this could be where Elon Musk comes into the picture. Twitter's stock price spiked on Monday after Musk's announcement, and so far it's stayed there. What's more, he and Twitter's leadership have expressed interests in some of the same technology, namely cryptocurrency and blockchain products. And it might not stop there.
Think about the different properties that he has built and accumulated over the years. Where does Twitter fit into any of those? It's not exactly clear, but I'm sure Elon Musk has ideas to use Twitter inside Tesla to make it a more engaging platform or some of the other companies he owns.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
After a contentious MLB offseason marked by a three-month lockout, baseball is back. A number of changes have been implemented with the new collective bargaining agreement, like an expanded postseason. Plus, the league will now allow a new anti-sign-stealing electronic device that will let the catcher tap a button on a wristband, allowing the pitcher to hear the chosen pitch in his ear. There are concerns, however, that the lockout has led to the loss of fans. For more on all of that, Perspective producer Leighton Schneider spoke with ESPN Major League Baseball analyst Jessica Mendoza.
What do you think the mood is when it comes to America's pastime?
A lot of excitement.
I'm just happy to have baseball back here. We're on the corner.
I mean, there was 99 days of lockout, and I think for a lot of us, we weren't sure if this day was going to come anytime soon. So the fact that we're looking at just a week later than what was supposed to happen, that baseball is being played starting today, it's exciting.
And you just mentioned it, we did have a 99-day lockout, and there was some very contentious negotiations on both sides of the issue. A lot of fans were angry at the Players Association and the owners. How much harm did negotiations do to baseball?
I don't think it did. I honestly think in the moment, for sure. I mean, it was a ton of negativity. I think when we get into games, and this is just talking with friends, I think everyone who was in it was like, this is catastrophic. And I think honestly, it would have been had this season started 4 months late, 2 months late, that we didn't get to do 162 games. But ultimately, for the casual fan that's going to look up in July and notice that there really wasn't any difference at all, just what was happening in the off season versus what we've seen in baseball's past when we've had
Very
lockouts during the season.
From the game back then are still around now. If that's not resonating through the minds of the people at the top of Major League Baseball and at the top of the Major League Baseball Players Association, they need to reassess their priorities. If you start
and
losing
they were never
games,
able to even complete the season or have
fans,
a World Series or get all the games fans, in or stats were skewed, I mean, that affected everything. But for this year, I mean, if we look back on 2022, we'll remember what happened leading into it. But I don't think it affects anything once we get going.
So the last time there was a lockout in 1994, it took about 11 seasons for in-stadium attendance to rebound. In the past couple years before the last two pandemic-era seasons, attendance started kind of slipping back down the slope. So are you worried fans won't show up to games, or do you think they're going to come back hard since we're pretty much back to normal now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it affecting anything at this point. If I'm just talking to my brother-in-law, who had big Mariners tickets for next week, was bringing his son, and I mean, none of those games got canceled. They're still happening. I mean, if anything, I think there was that scare of like, oh shoot, like, am I not going to be able to go watch my team this summer? You look at when families, when, you know, fans want to attend games, all those games are still happening. And if anything, there was that fear that this might have been taken away.
With the new CBA, there was a bunch of new rules that were put into the season.
The playoffs will expand from 10 to 12 teams. The National League will now use designated hitters. And there's now a limit on the number of times players can be optioned to the minor leagues.
But a new rule that just came out this week, I thought was most intriguing. It was the PitchCom pitching device. So what do you think of the device? And will it help with, you know, the whole sign stealing?
Well, absolutely. You can't steal what you can't see. And that's a huge thing. And the sign stealing's, you know, been there forever. As long as baseball, you know, signs from the catcher have been there. For the fact that now, I think it's so cool. They have these transmitters, the catchers, on their wrist, where they can basically send the sign through the transmitter. And then the pitcher will have lined within their hat, these transmitters that will come through on earpieces.
Cutter. Hold and step off.
So, I mean, we're looking at just like a really cool technology, but honestly, Leighton, what I'm most excited about is the fact that this is going to help the pace of the game. That's what they've seen from spring training games already. You think about the amount of time going through all the different signals, because it's not just like, hey, I'm throwing down a one for a fastball. You have this entire coding system of like the numbers that you're throwing down to try to not get the sign stealed. Now it's like, just give me a fastball up and in. Give me a changeup down and away. Like, as simple as that, we're going to see the pace of play, which we know in baseball is absolutely needed.
And I thought it was fascinating that the inventors of this initially had it for their magic act. And the fact that you can go from magic to the MLB is just fascinating.
So so cool. So
Jessica Mendoza is a ESPN MLB analyst talking about the start of the MLB season. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Leighton Schneider. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.
This is what being live is all about.
Fuel.
This is ABC News Live.
All right, we're going to move back. Let's move back.
We're surrounded by people
squeezing into this bomb shelter.
Run, urgent delivery, run.
Not afraid to go there.
So my question, Mr. President, what are you so afraid of?
Breaking news, live events.
This is the moment.
Lift off.
Streaming straight to you, anytime, anywhere.
You just met one friend right here.
This is ABC News Live.
Thanks for streaming with us.